And so to another great critic, Noam Chomsky. Professionally, he's preeminent in the field of linguistics, a discipline he invigorated with the development of theories positing an innate human capacity to structure language, deep grammar, hardwired into the mind, and consistent across history, geography, ethnicity. Publicly, he's best known as an activist and a dissident, the most important in the United States, where his sustained attacks on the uses and abuses of power by the Land of the Free's corporate, military, and political elites have turned him into a 21st century version of the Hebrew prophet Amos. Like the herdsman from Tekoa who turned up in Judea in the 8th century BCE to call the powerful to account, Chomsky too plays down the suggestion that there's anything special about his activism. It's street-level stuff, originating in family life in Jewish New York in the 20s and 30s, lining up today with activists protesting the World Trade Organization, US activity in Colombia, terror in East Timor, and the media's collusion in manufacturing consent to these and other injustices. So we read in a new book of conversations with David Barsamian called Propaganda and the Public Mind. I spoke to Noam Chomsky at his office in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology about the recent general election and the visit of President Bush to Europe. The latter was here to drum up support for the US missile defense policy, not an issue that got much of an airing on the hustings. Did that surprise him?
No, it wasn't discussed in the November election either in the United States. It's very typical for topics not to be discussed if there happens to be a sharp difference of opinion between dominant domestic sectors, business sectors primarily, and the general public. In such cases, issues are simply not part of the electoral process. This is quite dramatic in the United States. Not only was this not discussed, but there was no discussion at all of the issues that are polls reveal are the primary concerns of the public, those connected to what are misleadingly called trade agreements, the trade deficit, capital mobility, the investor rights agreements. These are matters on which the public has quite strong positions, and so does the business world, except they're opposite positions. And they didn't come up at all, which took a lot of discipline, since this was right before the summit meeting, the Summit of the Americas meeting, which then took place a couple months later in April, where the prime topic was exactly this, the so-called free trade area of the Americas.
Now, Britain seems to be catching up with America in this respect, in that it wasn't that long ago that those kind of issues would get an airing and a debate, even though a circumscribed one. What seems to have happened now is that if you do raise those issues, you're looked upon rather wearyingly as if you're really just trying to throw a spanner into the works, as if the smooth government and efficient running of the economy and the political system is somehow at stake, and all you seek to do is obstruct it. Should you bring up any objection to the proposals?
That's correct. I mean, there is a kind of a political convergence. They have various names for it, like the third way. You know, the systems are a little bit different. I wouldn't compare them exactly by any means. So, for example, the British Labour Party still has some residue, I don't know how much, of the fact that it was a constituency party with popular organized forces behind it, like the unions. That's much less true in the United States. But there's a lot of similarities, and there's nothing particularly novel about this. This is a constant battle. In fact, Britain and the United States are a little unusual throughout the last century in that they were the most democratic countries. From, you go back a century ago, Britain and the United States were undoubtedly the most democratic countries. And they were also the ones that recognized the need for more careful management of the public mind, as the British Ministry of Information put it. You had to manage the public mind to ensure that people wouldn't get the wrong idea. It's in the early part of the last century that the public relations industries developed dramatically in both the United States and England. Those were the two places, with a very explicit commitment to, as their leaders put it, regimenting the minds of men the way an army regiments their bodies. Ensuring British Conservative Party recognized that it, with the increasing franchise and the birth of a parliamentary Labour Party and so on, it couldn't expect automatically to control the political system. And it therefore committed itself to what it called political warfare, making use of the techniques of propaganda that had been honed during the First World War, when the British Ministry of Information, as it put it, sought to control the the minds of the world, primarily the minds of American intellectuals, who it was trying desperately, of course, to drive into a war fever so that they would organize a kind of a jingoist reaction in the United States, which would lead the United States into war. That all succeeded brilliantly. And the lessons were the United States also had a state propaganda agency. It was called the Committee on Public Information. These Orwellian terms, as long before Orwell, of course, are very typical. So the British Ministry of Information, the U.S. Woodrow Wilson's Committee on Public Information, both had major propaganda tasks, and they were quite impressed by their success in achieving them. And that was noticed, among others, by the business world. It was a great shot in the arm to the public relations industry. In fact, some of its leaders came out of Wilson's commission, also to progressive intellectuals, people like, say, Walter Lippmann, who was the dean of American journalists for leading public intellectual through most of the 20th century. His background was also in Woodrow Wilson's propaganda commission, and he too was impressed and concluded that manufacturing consent, it's his phrase, I've borrowed it, manufacturing consent is a kind of a core element for the practice of democracy. It is necessary in order to assure that the public remain mere spectators, not participants, while the responsible men do the important work, people like him. That's comparable to the British Conservative Party view that I just mentioned. In fact, it's quite widespread within the political system, the intellectual world, academic social science developed very similar ideas. There were others who noticed it too. For example, Adolf Hitler is a famous example of someone who was greatly impressed by the Anglo-American propaganda systems. He attributed Germany's defeat to their enormous success, which he said Germany couldn't counter. That's a correct observation. And he pledged that next time around, Germany would have a propaganda system that could match that of the democracies. So these are quite important. It's much beyond that. The public relations industry also recognized that in order to ensure that the public would be out of the political arena, that they would be spectators and not participants, it would be necessary to find ways to divert them, not just to regiment their minds, but also to divert them to what were called superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption. In other words, if you can get people kind of hooked in on consumption, as the, get them to identify their self-image, their existence, as the number of shoes that they have, and, of course, trap them in debt, then they're, you don't have to bother regimenting their minds. You've already got them controlled in a deeper sense. These are very conscious and very sensible ideas. It makes perfect sense that they should develop in the more democratic societies. And what you were describing before, I think, is an expected outcome of a century of dedicated effort to carry out perfectly reasonable tasks.
Sounds like those forces have been incredibly successful, and they've achieved in manufacturing precisely the consent they set out to manufacture. What then would they make of unanticipated protest? I'm thinking of something like Seattle or Washington, which really did seem to catch those elite interests completely unawares.
Well, I don't think that they have been fantastically successful. They would like to think that they are. And if you look over just, say, the 20th century, actually this goes back further, but let's just keep the 20th century. If you look, there's kind of a cycle of a feeling of triumphalism, end of history, utopia of the masters, it's all over. And then a recognition that it all collapsed, we've got to start all over again. So the 1920s were a period of euphoria, particularly in the United States. The labor movement had been completely smashed. Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare had severely undermined independent thought, any kind of opposition. The leading political opponent and intellectual opponent, Eugene Debs, was in jail, you know, because he dared to question the nobility of Wilson's war. Labor was virtually destroyed. And it looked like just, you know, utopia had arrived, the end of history. Well, a couple of years later came the 1930s, when it totally collapsed. The country was practically in a revolution. And that continued right through the war. I mean, the war ended, the Second World War, with very strong commitment, worldwide, in fact, but also in the United States, to kind of social democratic policies, what became welfare state policies. And it was necessary to beat that back. A major propaganda campaign, a huge one, began. It's been pretty well studied in the academic literature from the late 40s to try to drive the population back into obedience and quiescence, get them to hate the government, to hate unions, demand that business run everything, to privatize their lives and existence. This huge propaganda right through the late 40s and the early 50s, combined with legislation and other things. I mean, the Cold War was used effectively. You know, the Chinese are coming, the Russians are coming, you have to huddle under the power of the state and so on. By the end of the 50s, it was considered to have been successful. Remember, that was the period of end of ideology. It's all over. You know, nothing to discuss anymore.
I thought that was a more recent illusion.
That's the late 1950s.
Not just Fukuyama and the end of history, then.
That was called the end of ideology. Okay? I'm saying this is cyclic. By the late 1950s, it was quiescent, passive. The end of ideology happened to be a book by Daniel Bell, but that was the intellectual mood of the time. We've won. Then came the 60s. Tremendous ferment, unexpected, all over the place. Had a major civilizing effect on the society. From the early 70s, the backlash begins in many ways, the predictable backlash. And we're now in the middle of it. But it's not successful. That's the reason why, to get back to your first question, that's the reason why major issues of great concern to the public simply are excluded from electoral campaigns and are excluded from media commentary. If the public was under control, there would be no need to exclude these things. For example, if the business world and the media and the political leaders felt that they could gain the acquiescence of the public to the so-called free trade area of the Americas, they'd talk about it instead of keeping it secret. And the same with the missile defense, incidentally, which is not a missile defense program. It has to do with militarization of space, very serious issue.
One of the areas in which those elite interests seem to me to have been successful, and arguably, is the way they've manufactured the debate. Now, it seems to me that even until quite recently, 5, 10, 15 years ago in Britain, I don't know about in the US, there was territory you could occupy that would allow you an angled view on the success of the market or the ambitions of the market, the totalitarian tendencies of the market. That seems to have been eroded almost to the point of invisibility now, that those forces succeed in presenting themselves as a condition of existence, not as an ideology. And the problem for those of us who would seek to oppose it or seek to challenge it is that we have to look behind us and find new territory, stable territory, on which to stand to make that critique, because the old territory seems somehow to have fallen away from beneath our feet.
The way the world looks to me is almost precisely the opposite. I think what you said is exactly true of elite circles. So it's true of elite educated circles. Meanwhile, outside of them, there is overwhelming opposition, growing overwhelming opposition to this entire ideology. It began to be very visible in the 1980s in the Third World, with mass popular movements in Brazil, India, elsewhere, making a lot of progress, incidentally. By the 1990s, it had expanded to the North, and then you can't ignore it any longer. When it finally broke through, you know, became so visible in demonstrations that you couldn't ignore it, like Seattle, well, yes, then it became, you know, it was on the front pages. But the things that happened, for example, at Seattle, they don't come from nowhere. That's the result of extensive organizing and education going on very broadly. Recall that Seattle had striking linkages between sectors of the population that had in the past been hostile. So steel workers and environmentalists and the gay activists, for example, they had not been in love with each other in the past, but they were doing the same things at Seattle. Furthermore, there were grassroots linkages with the Third World. One striking thing about Seattle, and this is quite new, is linkages with mass popular movements in the Third World, which were much larger and much more advanced, but they did tie up and interact with the Seattle demonstrators, and this simply continues. In fact, the reason why things like the FTAA, and it's not the first time, why they have to be kept secret, is because of a recognition on the part of elites that the public is strongly against them. And I should say that recognition is quite explicit. So there's a debate that has been going on in the last couple of years in the United States. I presumably there's something comparable in England, over what's called fast-track legislation. Fast-track gives the executive, the president, the right to enter into international agreements in secret without discussion and without publicity. And then Congress is given the choice of ratifying it or saying no, which means ratifying it. Notice that's a duplicate of the Stalinist system. In the Stalinist system, the supreme leader makes the decisions and the Duma is able to say yes. Okay, that's fast track. The business world is totally in favor of it. The intellectuals are almost totally in favor of it. A political system, of course. The media regard it as such an obvious good thing that we can't even talk about it. We must have fast track. What they call it is a trade measure. We need it for trade. And there's something true about that. If what they call trade, and again, it isn't trade, if what they call trade does come to public discussion, they know they can never ram it through. So they need the Stalinist system, fast track. But they can't get it. And they know why they can't get it. The last time it was voted down, the Wall Street Journal had the business reporting is typically very honest, Financial Times even better. The Wall Street Journal had an article in which they said, well, look, this is a no-brainer. I mean, it's such an obvious good thing, the Stalinist system, that everybody has to be in favor of it. But the trouble is, they said, that opponents of fast track have what they called an ultimate weapon. The ultimate weapon is that the population is opposed. They want to know what's going on. They want to participate in discussions about their future. And therefore, unless we can keep it secret from them, we can't get it through. That's a recognition of reality. It's the same recognition of reality when the World Trade Organization schedules its next meeting in Qatar in the interests of transparency and democracy. They're concerned. They understand it and they're concerned.
What perhaps startling about it is the blandness with which they acknowledge the kind of naked and unaccountable pursuit of power that they prosecute. It seems extraordinary that they can say those things without everyone falling on them and calling them to account for what they propose.
Well, again, we sort of have a different perception of reality. It's true that they say those things to each other, but then that's normal. You know, I think if you look at elite literature throughout modern history, internally, it's very frank. On the other hand, it's not true that they can get away with it. The public is incensed, and overwhelmingly. And that's why you see this growing opposition.
And yet they do seem to get away with it. When you were talking about Seattle earlier, it reminded me of the miners' strike in the 80s in Britain, where again you saw a very fruitful, very positive alliance of all kinds of separate interest groups from right across the spectrum, to the case where you had kind of gay groups in the metropolitan centres supporting miners' communities in South Wales or in North Yorkshire, a political reality which hadn't existed before and was life-changing for all of those people involved, yet it had no purchase on power. It did nothing to delay or even deflect the victory of the Tory government and the National Coal Board when it came to the real key battles in that dispute. And I wonder if it's not the same case in Seattle and Washington, that the protest has no purchase on power and becomes decorative and not political.
They have substantial purchase on power, and we don't know how much they have. I mean, the purchase on power is sometimes enormous. So in 1998, the OECD, the rich countries of the world, we're trying to ram through in secret a major investor rights agreement, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. It was negotiated for several years, in secret, of course. They didn't want the public to know about it. It was kept secret by the media till the end. It sort of leaked out in the last few months, some of the details of it. Within months, there was extensive grassroots activism all over much of the world, a lot of it organized through the Internet, since you couldn't do anything through the media. There were a few exceptions. I've actually reviewed the worldwide media coverage, if you like. There were a few exceptions. But basically, it was kept secret. It became known. Within months, there was massive popular protest. It was supposed to be ratified at, I think it was April 1998. It wasn't. I mean, there were all kinds of excuses given. But an honest report about what happened, a very honest report, several, appeared in the London Financial Times, very good newspaper, and I just urge that you look back. What they described was that, as they put it, hordes of vigilantes converged on the OECD and the corporate sector and terrorize them. You know, these poor, weak little people who are the most powerful concentration of power in world history couldn't stand up against the hordes of vigilantes, you know, activists from Canada and Brazil and so on, and they had to back out. Then they quoted trade ministers as saying, this is a catastrophe. If this goes on, we will no longer be able to make international agreements in secret and have them rubber stamped by Parliament because the hordes of vigilantes are at our throats. Well, for various reasons, the OECD backed off on that arrangement, but they're now trying to reinstitute it. They're reinstituting it in secret through the General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS at Geneva, through the FTAA and the Summit of the Americas, and in various other ways, hoping that the horde of vigilantes, that is the overwhelming majority of the population, won't find out what they're up to and will not organize and act to reverse it. I don't want to sound like Pollyanna. I mean, we happen to be in a period of regression, that is, transfer of power towards unaccountable private tyrannies, diminishing of the public arena, transferring it towards unaccountable private power. Yes, we're in the middle of that period, but it's not for the first time. It's a constant cycle. Actually, you can trace it back to the early 19th century, when there are victories for authority, private power, unaccountability, attacks on democracy, pacification of the population, commonly leading to the euphoria about end of history, end of ideology, you know, we've won utopia and so on. And then it turns out that popular activism and commitment overcomes it. And if you look at this cycle over time, here I think one should be optimistic. The cycle is generally upwards. That is, over time, through, say, the 20th century, the general tendency has been, despite the opposition of power sectors, has been towards more public participation, more democracy, more human rights, more gains. And I think that'll continue. It doesn't mean that every single moment is a moment of progress. It certainly is not.
Do you think there's an encouragement to be drawn from the very smoothness of the kind of discourse, the language that those power elites use? I was very struck reading some of the stuff you've been writing recently about how the difference between what is said and what is meant in that kind of discourse has never really been more acute. It seems almost to be about opposites now. For instance, when, in the case of Reaganomics, when they talk about free trade, they mean in the exact difference, a system of thoroughgoing intervention. Or in the matter of third world debt, when they talk about the debt is owed by these poor debtor nations, it's the exact opposite. The debt is in fact owed by the elites who've distanced themselves precisely from those populations.
Oh, that's perfectly true. I mean, the crafting of terminology to disguise action is very standard. You didn't have to wait for Orwell for that, actually. Pascal wrote brilliantly about it centuries ago. And I mentioned the two major propaganda agencies at the beginning of the 20th century in the two democracies, the Ministry of Information and the Committee of Public Information, both of them, of course, concerned with concealing information and producing lies, but they called themselves Ministries of Information. But you're absolutely right. In the last couple of years, it's become kind of a joke. The new Bush tax bill, you know, that was just passed, its official name, which I can never remember, it's the acronym for it is RELIEF, R-E-L-I-E-F, and I think it stands for Restoring Earnings, Lifting Individuals, and Empowering Families. In fact, what it actually stands for is transferring a huge amount of wealth into the pockets of super rich people and smashing everyone else in the face. But it's Restoring Earnings, Lifting Individuals, and Empowering Families. I mean, Orwell wouldn't have even bothered laughing.
I wonder if it suggests that a good place for activism, contemporary activism, to take hold is precisely with people who have a professional interest in language like you do. And I wonder to what extent do you think that your political activism is an extension of or merely relates to your work, technical work, in linguistics?
Approximately zero. The point is that the decoding of this charlatanism and trickery on the part of the educated classes does not require any special knowledge. There's no professional insight that you have to have in order to discover the farce of the British Ministry of Information or Bush's tax proposal. It's transparent. It's on the surface. Every person who puts his mind to it can figure it out instantly. I mean, linguistics is an interesting topic. You know, I love to work on it. It has interesting results. Let me just make a general comment about this. I mean, we happen to be living in a period in which professional experts gain an enormous amount of authority. Whether it's deserved or not is another matter. In fact, I think it often isn't. But whatever you think about that, they have that carries with it a responsibility. It carries with it the responsibility to make very clear to the general public exactly how much you know and how much you don't know. So if you're an economist talking about, say, the wonders of the free market, you should begin this statement by saying, I don't know what I'm talking about. There is virtually no empirical evidence to support what I'm saying. In fact, the empirical evidence is overwhelmingly to the contrary. There are some interesting theories, which are sort of fun to prove theorems about, and they may tell you something. You know, they're worth knowing. But don't take me too seriously. In fact, I should approach what I say with humility. And in fact, the better economists and, you know, even the Bank for International Settlements talking to each other do say, look, we have to adopt a position of humility in the recognition that we basically do not understand very much about these complicated matters. Now, that should be every professional's stand. Unless they can really show that they have deep professional knowledge which applies to human affairs in some, or social affairs or whatever, in some significant fashion, but then they've got to make the argument. They can't just say it because I am a professor at a university.
In your case, then, I wonder if we might look a bit further back then. Your father was a distinguished Hebraist. You mm-hmm. too have taught Hebrew. And I wonder if growing up in that culture, coming from that kind of culture, with the extraordinary battery of techniques it allows you to bring to bear on the way language operates, if that's something that's been a constant for you in your career since then, both in linguistics but also as an activist, something about breaking the spell of language, seeing how it works its mysteries, which is a kind of great...
I can just tell you, for what it's worth, not much, that in my personal experience, the biggest influence on my life in all of these areas was an uncle who never got past fourth grade. My family was mostly unemployed immigrant, you know, East European immigrants. He lived in the slums, in and out of a complicated life. He happened to be disabled, so he was able to run a newsstand. During the New Deal, there were some benefits given to disabled people, and he was allowed to run a small newsstand in New York. He was the best-read person I'd ever met in my life, still to this day, the most intellectual, the most critical. In fact, his newsstand became a center for European emigre intellectuals, where they would come and hang around. This is the 1930s, and argue about Freud and Marx and the war and all sorts of fascinating things. As a 10-year-old kid, working in the newsstand was just utterly fascinating. And talking to him was, you know, it just changed my life. My point is that these things are on the surface. If you want to put your attention to them, you can figure them out.
Noam Chomsky, Propaganda and the Public Mind, Conversations with David Barsamian, is published by the Pluto Press.